A Map of the World, Disc 15.
Mrs. Nancy Sheridan, Rafferty's dream come true, appeared before us on Tuesday morning. She sat down, wiping her runny eye with her ironed white handkerchief. Teresa, who had been unable to come to the proceedings the week before because of work, was sitting behind me, next to Howard. When she said later in the hall that she had prayed for a witness like Mrs. Sheridan, Howard looked down and his mouth curved slowly into a smile. Mrs. Sheridan was a good Catholic who had been bearing children since 1960 and had only recently, 3 years before, finished with the stillbirth of her 11th baby. Her tailored maroon suit had been out of date for so long it had come back into fashion, and it still fit reasonably well. She wasn't any taller than 5 feet, and she had short, dull black hair. Robbie and his mother had lived next door to the Sheridans, in a rental house, for 3 months the previous spring. Mrs. Sheridan deplored the fact that Mr. Gillis, the landlord, always had undesirable people as tenants, and that he didn't keep up with essential repairs. Rafferty did his best to hold her to the subject, but with a captive audience she couldn't seem to help making asides about the ills of society. There weren't any boys in the neighborhood Robbie's age, and Mrs. Sheridan told us that for a while Robbie latched on to her 8-year-old son, Jack. After a few weeks, however, she had had to prohibit Jack from playing with Robbie because of the child's foul language, the likes of which had never before reached her ears. "I'm not inclined to repeat any of those words," she asserted, "even for the benefit of the court." "That won't be necessary," Rafferty assured her. With Rafferty's prodding, Mrs. Sheridan related an incident that had taken place in May. She had gone looking for Jack at about 7:30 in the evening. She had called first and then rung the dinner bell several times. He was ordinarily reliable, and she began to worry. Some of the older children had gone with Mr. Sheridan on a fishing trip, and it was just going to be herself and Jack for dinner. It was a rare occasion to have one child at home, and she was going to take him out to Taco Bell for a treat. She walked down the block, down Main Street, where they lived. She turned the corner and followed the path to the subdivisions where he sometimes went to play with school friends. There was a group of boys skateboarding in a driveway, but he wasn't among them. They said he hadn't been around for an hour or so, that they thought he had gone home. She became very anxious. "We all know what the world is coming to," she said, looking at the jury for confirmation. Although Jack was her 10th child, she didn't feel that she was overprotective, due to her long experience. There had been recent rumors of a man in a green pickup truck harassing young girls. The year before, a Walworth County boy had disappeared, plucked off the street, no trace. Even a seasoned mother worried. I don't think there was anyone in the room, not Rafferty, not Susan Dirks, not Judge Peterson himself, who wanted to endanger their reputations by interrupting Mrs. Sheridan, or objecting to her statements, or telling her to hurry along. On the evening of May 23rd, she stopped in front of the Mackesies, having decided she'd check at their house before she walked all the way over to the playground. She had told her son not to play with Robbie, but Jack was a kind-hearted boy who might have responded if Robbie had been in need. It wasn't impossible, she thought, that Jack had gone into the house to assist him in some way. "Wouldn't Carol Mackesy have been on the premises?" Rafferty asked. "To put a Band-Aid on his knee or pour a glass of milk?" Nancy Sheridan shook her head and again wiped her face. She seemed not exactly to be crying, although there was a steady stream coming from her right eye. "She often left that poor boy at home by himself," she said. "Jack would go over there and come back and tell me that Robbie was alone, eating from a box of Fruit Loops." While Dirks was making a hearsay objection, Mrs. Sheridan went right on talking. It's bad families that are spoiling it for everyone else. I found it impossible to believe that a mother would leave a kindergarten-age child alone for more than 10 minutes.
Sustained, Judge Peterson said.
He never looked me in the eye. Mrs. Sheridan wasn't hearing either the judge or Rafferty, both of whom were trying to get her to stop. A mother doesn't raise 10 children without knowing that that boy was afraid to look up and see that no one was there to love him. Mrs. Dirks made a number of objections during the testimony, and she asked that certain asides be struck from the record. Although Peterson granted her some small victories, he was clearly disposed toward the star witness, who Rafferty referred to in private as the mother of us all. Mrs. Sheridan didn't know precisely how often Robbie was left alone, but it seemed to be on a regular basis that he was at home when Mrs. Mackesy's car was gone. As far as she could see, there was no babysitter watching out for the child. It was none of her business, she said, but it was hard not to notice him looking at her from his dining room window. She'd wave, she said, but he wouldn't wave back. She could feel him watching her so that sometimes, before she looked to see if he was there, she went and closed the curtains. On the night in question, however, when she was out looking for Jack, she went up to the Mackesy's door and was about to ring the bell. There was loud music coming from the back of the house, and she thought it might be a party. "I was about to go," she said, "because I knew my Jack wouldn't have come over to the house under those circumstances," when Robbie appeared at the door. He was usually a, well, angry-looking little guy. He seemed to want to take on the world by himself, bless his heart. You could see all that's tender in that child just hardening up.
"What happened next?" Rafferty asked.
"I hadn't ever spoken more than 2 words to the mother," she said, in no relation to the question. "She probably didn't think that someone such as myself had anything to offer."
She took a deep breath and felt her collar to make sure it was still in place.
"Robbie said I should come in. He said, 'You should come in.' I said, 'No, no, thank you,' that I was looking for Jack." 'You have to,' he said. He insisted. He was stuttering, and he was looking at me for once, with those great big eyes. I was surprised by his familiarity. It frightened me, because he looked—"
"How did he look, Mrs. Sheridan?"
"His eyes were huge, as I said. He was so pale. He was scared, Mr. Rafferty. His little body was quivering. I didn't know what to think. I was afraid for a minute for my Jack, afraid there'd been an accident. 'What is it, Robbie?' I asked him. He said, 'Come and look.' 'Is it Jack?' He said no, he hadn't seen Jack. I didn't want to go inside that place, but I followed him."
"Where did he take you, Mrs. Sheridan?"
"He took me to the back of the house, to the den. The door was closed most of the way."
She bent her head, apparently unable to continue.
"What did you see, Mrs. Sheridan?"
"This is not easy for me, Mr. Rafferty."
"I appreciate that."
She gripped both armrests with her hands and sat straight.
"I looked."
"And what did you see?"
"It was dark and the music was loud."
"What could you make out?"
"There was something adult going on, something a child shouldn't have seen. The music was so loud it made your heart beat hard."
"What was happening in that room?"
"It was dark, like I said, but I could see her, Mrs. Mackesy, on the sofa with one of her men. They were like animals, Mr. Rafferty. That's what it looked like. She on all fours. He biting at her neck. Robbie had to scream at me, 'My mama's getting hurt.' He took my hand and pulled me away into the kitchen.
He was crying, saying something about how it would happen to us, too.
The music stopped then, and that child barreled into me. He said I had to get out of the house. He as much as pushed me out the back door, Mr. Rafferty.
Did you see anyone besides Robbie on that evening?
No, I did not. I was extremely upset. I wanted to take the boy, but he closed the door. I ran from that house as fast as my legs could carry me. I ran straight upstairs to my own home and saw that my Jack was in his bedroom after all. I was so relieved. I should have called the police. I know that.
Did you tell anyone about your experience?
That's a very good question, Mr. Rafferty.
He didn't flinch, didn't as much as crack the slightest smile.
My husband was on a fishing trip and wouldn't be home until the end of the week. I felt that I needed to discuss with him any action we would take. I didn't feel that I should take steps without my husband. I was aware that my neighbor entertained men, and they were often large, burly fellows. You can't be sure if people are on drugs, can't be sure of their condition. You can't be certain about anything in these times. I wasn't prepared to call the police myself and possibly place my family in danger. I'm not proud of my inaction, but I felt that I was safeguarding my own children. I know that Robbie trusted me and that by not calling for help, I violated that trust. It's something I live with.
When did you next see the Mackesies?
I saw Robbie out in the yard 15 or 20 minutes after I left him. His mother called him in a few minutes later. To be frank, I was upset enough so that I began to wonder if I'd been dreaming. As it turned out, the boy and his mother disappeared a few days later. I heard that they were evicted, but I don't know. I came home from a meeting and their curtains were down. The car was gone. Everything looked empty. It was a tremendous relief to me. Someone on the block said they'd rented a house in the country. I decided that I would continue to pray for them, but that I would otherwise put them out of my mind.
When Rafferty finally sat down, he shifted his eyes in my direction and raised his eyebrows for a fraction of a second. As Susan Dirks got up, Sherry, from wherever she was, home with her three Dickenses or still in jail, shouted, "Oh boy, she in deep shit." I wonder now when Susan Dirks knew that Mrs. Mackesy was either grossly deluded or lying. I wonder if she realized she would lose badly when the other boys' charges were dropped, when even Myra Flint couldn't get them to say the same thing twice. Rafferty had said many times that mine was the sort of case that should never have come to trial. He placed the blame solely on Susan Dirks. I know very well the urge to protect your failings, a need so strong you make up a different world to inhabit. Mrs. Mackesy had had a need to think differently about her life. Perhaps there was enough force in her need that even Susan Dirks had been convinced. Whatever Dirks's true feelings at the time of the trial, she gave Mrs. Sheridan her best shot. If the room was dark, how could she have seen anyone? How long did she look? 4 seconds? 5 seconds? How could she tell there were two people?
"I know what I have seen," Mrs. Sheridan said.
She wasn't going to be undone. She had God on her side. She wasn't going to let an infertile woman lawyer who was too big for her britches diminish an incident that had changed her own life, that had made her scrape up $30 she couldn't really spare to send to a senator she felt had the right beliefs.
"Miss Dirks," she said. "Mrs. Dirks, whatever you are. There were people in that room. They were hurting one another for
for reasons I am not going to attempt to understand. The life was scared out of that boy. There was evil in that house, and your insinuations that I have somehow invented a story so beyond my ken are sorely trying my patience."
After Mrs. Sheridan's testimony, Rafferty and I went into the holding room. Howard trudged off to find us some sweet rolls. Rafferty put his hands to his wide-open mouth and wiggled his hips in a way that didn't become him.
"I'm gloating," he said. "I'm gloating. I'll pay for it someday, but I can't help it right now. I can't help it."
"Stop," I said.
"Look."
He grabbed my shoulders and shook me. "When some maniac from Hollywood comes knocking at your door for your story, okay? And you sell it for $1.5 million and you and Howard buy a 10-inch parcel in Montana right next to Tom Brokaw and Brooke Shields, okay? You with me?"
"Would you please stop?"
I said, laughing uneasily at his bulging eyes and the spit that was foaming around his mouth.
As part of the deal, you have to insist that Mrs. Sheridan play her own part. Not even what's-her-name, Streep, could get that accent down. You know how flat Mrs. Sheridan's Wisconsin Catholic vowels are. And with just that touch of whining in her voice, it's so fabulous. And no amount of onion balled up in a hanky could make just one eye run so righteously."
"Please," I said again.
I know. "But she is such a work of art, like the virgin she was appearing at Lourdes."
"Be quiet," I said.
"All right, okay.
I hope Howard gets something sinful, something chocolate and very sticky, made with cream and butter and several eggs."
By the time we were called back, Rafferty had collected himself. He cleared his throat, smoothed his plaid suit coat, put his head down, so humble, so manly, and walked into the courtroom. I have often thought about both Carol Mackesy and Mrs. Sheridan, together, as if they belonged in the same photograph. I persuaded myself that, in a sense, they needed one another. Carol had brought a suit against me without thinking about her past. Had she believed that modesty or politeness would keep her unconventional behavior out of the evidence? Did she believe in Dirks the way I believed in Rafferty? Our lawyers, we thought, would present us as our best selves. Or did Carol feel secure in her right to entertain her own friends in her own home? Teresa maintained that Carol's maternal instincts had finally kicked in, that those strong feelings overpowered her and made her take action. Teresa said that she probably had deep-seated guilt about Robbie, and in pursuing the case, she was overcompensating. Carol hadn't imagined there could be anyone quite like Mrs. Sheridan. Was the lady too good to be true? I often wondered. Or was it rather that in all of our lives there is a Mrs. Sheridan, seeing something in the dark and translating it into something fully formed? Mrs. Sheridan was perhaps Mrs. M. L. Glevich's beautiful and good sister. Mrs. Glevich stood in funeral lines, grocery store lines, listening, spying, talking, the words running out of her mouth like ink, leaving an indelible trail behind her. Mrs. Sheridan stayed at home, shut her curtains, and still truth came to her. She kept quiet until she was called upon by the mighty forces of civilization, the court of law, where she believed justice was carried out. On Tuesday afternoon, Rafferty called Teresa to the stand. I had asked him several times if it wouldn't be better to hire someone else, someone who hadn't known me, who didn't have the complication of our particular relationship. Each time he insisted that she was perfect for us, not in spite of our friendship, but because of our association. She's a great expert, too. She's always lucid, human, commonsensical. The jury deep down doesn't care how many degrees a person has if he's compelling and speaks their language. I had talked to Teresa on the phone since our meeting at the A&W, but I hadn't seen her.
I had always envied her fair skin, her long eyelashes, her curly hair, as well as her sunny nature. In court, she was virtually unrecognizable. She'd lost some weight so that her round face had become angular. She had planes and cheekbones, what she had always wished for. She'd taken her glasses off or gotten contacts. She had previously had a schoolgirl sort of charm, an adorableness. But in the witness box, she looked as if she'd grown up, come into her prime. She was dressed simply in a blue sweater and a dark blue and crimson skirt. Rafferty asked her to explain the guidelines she followed for sexual abuse cases. She moistened her lips and smoothed her skirt down her lap. I found it painful to watch her in the beginning. In the same way, it will be difficult to watch Emma or Claire play an instrument at a recital. I'm sure I was more nervous for Teresa than she was for herself. "First of all," she said in a loud, clear, unfaltering voice, "I always err in favor of the child. What do I mean by that? I don't think that children are capable of lying about their feelings. In other words, I always believe a child's feelings. It is essential to listen very carefully to a child, but it is just as important to be sensitive to details, to be aware that children often mix fantasy with fact. I have myself seen children, in my own practice, elaborate and get carried away with details, especially as they get further from the incident. I have seen child protection workers get into trouble because of various approaches that are still advocated and widely used, and which often mislead a victim. Could you describe those approaches, Mrs. Collins, which you believe mislead children?" The dictum, "children never lie," is often taken to extremes. I have found, in my practice, that children are often fanciful, that they sometimes say outrageous things that I'm certain have no basis in fact. In courts of law, we often establish that the child can distinguish between the truth and a lie. But that is a very different issue from whether or not the child will actually lie or embellish. I had never seen Teresa before in her professional capacity. She was capable, articulate, and impassioned without appearing rabid. "One of them mind doctors," I heard Dichette say. "Tell me your dreams and all that cockshit." "Second," she went on, "anatomically detailed dolls sometimes startle a child because of their unusual genital features. They invite a finger into their gaping holes. Give a child a wooden donut, and he will invariably place his fingers in the holes. I have seen professionals jump to conclusions based on a child's natural curiosity. The child often senses the importance the examiner places on the doll. He or she wants to please, or possibly get a reaction from the examiner. Third, there is a real problem, in spite of the fact that we know we should not, of the examiner asking leading questions. I myself have been guilty of asking specific questions such as, 'Does your daddy put his fingers in you just like that?'" "What's she talking about?" It was Dichette again, zinging through my mind. "What this motherfucker lecture?" I had tried to tell Teresa that day at the A&W that the girls in my pod had gotten inside of me, that they were real now, more real to me than they had ever been in jail in person. And there wasn't much good in feeling that I was one of them from a distance, from the safety of the outside world. Fourth, there is a danger that the examiners selectively ignore the impossible. Let me give you an example. If the child says, "My uncle abused me," we say, "Oh my," and we probe and set the wheels in motion to charge the uncle. If the child then says, "My uncle abused me during a family outing on the picnic table where everyone was eating," We, as examiners, tend to say, "Oh, Sally's tired out. We'll let her rest."
So, in your opinion, examiners hear only what they want to hear,
Rafferty said.
I'm saying that's a danger, yes.
Another typical problem in the field is the failure of the child protection worker to interview the accused or the adult accuser. We tend to take at face value the accusations, and we don't consider that there may have been fabrication. We think we don't need to hear another point of view because the child has told us everything. That is not always the case.
Mrs. Collins, there is, in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, a list of telling characteristics of what is known as the unattached child, or the character-disturbed child. Another name for the disorder is the antisocial personality disorder. Could you give us a profile of the character-disturbed child?
A young child with APD will not look you in the eye. The only time such a child has normal eye contact is when he is trying to manipulate and when he is angry. Character-disturbed children are quick to tell outrageous lies. The child may have a preoccupation with fire, blood, or gore. Many of these children have not bonded with their parents as infants. They will exhibit aggression and have marked control problems. In fact, the parents are often also angry and hostile people. Dr. Eugene Bailey told us that when a child is afflicted with post-traumatic stress syndrome, often that child's basic assumptions about his surroundings and himself have been upset. The child's belief in his personal invulnerability is shaken. He no longer has the perception of the world as meaningful, and he can also no longer see himself as positive, Rafferty said.
I agree with that assessment, Teresa said. Mrs. Collins, I realize that you are not a psychologist, but I respect your 12-year career as a family therapist. According to the state's expert, Robbie was suffering from PTSS. Having read the case records and in your experience, knowing Robbie and his family as you do, would you agree with Dr. Bailey's diagnosis?
Yes.
Based on your training and experience and your reading of the court record, would you also say to within a reasonable degree of therapeutic certainty that Robbie Mackesy exhibits some of the symptoms of a character-disturbed child?
Yes, I do, Mr. Rafferty.
Unattached children lie even when caught red-handed, do they not?
Quite often, yes. It is as if the child confuses the way he wishes life were with the way it actually is.
In your experience, Mrs. Collins, do you think it likely that a 6-year-old boy who'd seen his mother engaged in sex would experience trauma?
Mrs. Dirks objected, and for the first time Rafferty raised his voice.
Your Honor, he shouted, I am asking a hypothetical question.
Yes, quite definitely, Teresa was able to answer.
Is it your opinion that the child might experience terror not only for himself but also for his mother? Might he be afraid for her life?
Absolutely.
Is it possible that a young boy might imagine himself in the same danger as his mother? That a young boy might have the fear of that danger?
I think it's possible, Mr. Rafferty.
If that boy, in his worst fantasy, imagines himself in his mother's helpless position, might he invent a situation in which he triumphs over the danger, the evil?
Children often fantasize about conquering robbers, bullies, the bad guys.
I wondered if the jurors were thinking about what it must have been like for Robbie to come up the basement stairs when his mother called him, coming up the stairs and sitting down at his place. Maybe they were imagining Prim Grinder in the den, trying to figure out how to rewind the VCR.
Mrs. Mackesy might have had her robe on while she fried up hamburgers on the range. The fan wasn't on, and the doors were closed, and the room smelled of grease and cigarettes. Were they going to force him down on his knees? The boy might have wondered. "Where have you been?" she might have barked at him. "I thought you were over by the Sheridans." She didn't look as if she'd been hurt. He couldn't tell exactly if she was angrier than usual. "Look at me when I'm talking to you." He wanted to tell her that, if it would make her feel better, he'd kill Grinder for her. That's why he showed Mrs. Sheridan, so that Mrs. Sheridan could call the police and take the stranger away. He thought they'd be arriving any minute, with sirens and flashing lights. But when Grinder came into the kitchen, she started slamming down plates in front of the man, as if she wanted to feed him up. He couldn't tell if she liked him or not, the way she was slamming the plates down. He didn't understand it, any of it. And he wondered if someone did those terrible things to him, if she'd feel worried about him, and afterwards slam plates down in front of him and feed him full of good things. He remembered the time he got his hand stuck in the car door. She'd been mad that he'd been clumsy, but she'd also sat with him at the doctor's office, tickling his ear. It was confusing, the way she was being so nice and noisy and smiling at Grinder. And he wondered if that's what grown-ups did, hurt each other. I looked out the window while Rafferty went on with the questions, trying to think about Mrs. Mackesy, trying for the millionth time to imagine her side of the story. She had grown up with deaf parents and might have run wild with bad girls, coming home late and signing lies, squandering her promise on men who ill-treated her. She would probably always think of me as someone who was without question thoroughly evil. She wouldn't care that we'd lost a way of life. I had deserved my misfortunes, and so did my family. I wondered if she could ever begin to bring any of Robbie's tragedy back to herself. Before Rafferty finished with Teresa, he asked her, as I knew he would, about our friendship. I remember how she looked out at us, first at me, sitting at the table alone, and then at Howard, who was behind me. She studied us, as if she was evaluating our bonds. I thought she was going to get choked up. "Yes," she responded. "We were neighbors and friends."
"Did your children play together?"
"Very often. Sometimes several times a week."
"Did you ever suspect my client of neglect or foul play?"
"No," Teresa said.
"You never saw anything, any signs, any flares to alert you?"
"Never."
"Your daughter was always happy to go to the Goodwins?"
"Yes, thrilled."
"Would you allow your daughter to stay unchaperoned with the Goodwin family at this time?"
She was crying now, in her good old way, her professional mantle at her knees, revealing the woman, the mother. She was weeping so affectingly some of the jurors were dabbing their eyes. "I can't impress upon you enough," she said through her sniffles, "that Alice would never inflict, that she never did any of those things." I'd like to say that I wasn't afraid when I took the stand. I wished for the convictions and confidence of Mrs. Sheridan and the dignity of Teresa. I couldn't remember anything about our rehearsals except Paul's flatulent praise. I took a moment to pray while he gathered his papers. I prayed that I could stand up to the assistant DA as well as Teresa had, even though Dirks trashed her credentials. I sat with my shaking hands in my lap, feeling as if my mouth had been stuffed with sawdust. I looked at Paul, who had job happiness, who would go on to save someone else after he was through with me. We had gone through the questions several times. We had agreed on certain wording. It would all flow, he said, like a piece of cake. He began by asking me what I had been charged with that had been the occasion for my spending nearly 3 months in the county jail. I remembered my line. Sexual abuse, reckless endangerment, child abuse, I said. And how did you plead? Not guilty. And how did you find the jail? Dirks objected. Your Honor, Rafferty said, I think my client deserves to say a few sentences about her time in jail as a result of this charge. She was beaten and had a serious injury, so serious she was hospitalized. Peterson nodded his head. And how did you find the county jail? Rafferty asked again. I knew what he wanted me to say, that it had been the most difficult period of my life. That it had been sorely trying, being in an overcrowded facility with seasoned prisoners. That as a result of my beating, I had to have major surgery at St. Luke's Hospital. The words failed me. But I could see the girls plainly. Linnell, Dichette, Sherry, Debbie. Sitting in the back, watching with hope, scorn, affection, disinterest. I was in awe. I said, under my breath. You were what? I was in awe. Not something you'd like to repeat, I take it, he said quickly. No. He carried my log around in his hands, opening it, reading from it, as he asked me at length about specific visits Robbie had made in the previous year. Finally, he asked, In all of the what? 25 visits we have recorded here, Mrs. Goodwin. Did you ever touch Robbie in an inappropriate way? Yes, I said. What did you do to Robbie that you shouldn't have? I hit him. How many times did you hit him? Once. I hit him once on the face. I slapped him. Did you notify the principal that you'd hit the boy? No, I didn't. Why didn't you? I was ashamed. It is awful to lose your temper. What made you lose your temper, as you say? I closed my eyes, trying to fasten on the correct sequence. Robbie was a difficult child to treat, I said. He was often verbally abusive to adults. He seemed not to have any fear or respect. There was a pattern in his office visits. He would come to the door and stand and stare at me in a way that was extremely unnerving, and then he often made personal remarks. I had tried to get some guidance from both the principal and the school counselor. I wasn't answering in the succinct way we had practiced. I couldn't recall how I had justified the slap. His derision and his contempt overwhelmed me one day, I mumbled, and I slapped him. Is striking Robbie one of the charges that has been brought against you, Mrs. Goodwin? No. Why didn't Robbie tell his mother you hit him? I suppose Robbie may get hit at home. It may not have been anything out of the ordinary in his life. Mrs. Dirks objected on the grounds of hearsay, and the judge ordered the statement struck from the record. What did you mean, Mrs. Goodwin, when you said to Detective Grogan and Officer Melby that you'd hurt everybody? What did you mean by that? Our neighbor, a 2-year-old, had very recently drowned in our pond. I looked at Teresa as I spoke. I said again, she was 2 years old. Rafferty had told me I shouldn't, under any circumstances, volunteer that information. The judge had written a letter advising that both Dirks and Rafferty keep Elizabeth Collins out of the testimony. But it was important, wasn't it, that the jurors know the context? Rafferty himself had said as much. I no longer remembered what I had been supposed to say. I was under oath to tell the truth, and Lizzie's death was a good portion of the truth. I was stricken by that accident. It was an agonizing period. I didn't feel that I was taking good care of my children, my family, my friend. Everything fell apart for those few weeks after Lizzie drowned. I had no idea what the officers were asking me about that night, but my guilt was considerable. Dirks was standing up and yelling, as to be expected. Even Judge Peterson was on his feet. I guess that he called a recess because Dirks was running into the judge's chamber and Rafferty, head down, hands behind his back, was following. Rafferty said later that he'd never seen the judge so angry, that he shook the air as if to throttle Paul and shouted, "I granted your motion to keep Elizabeth out of the testimony, and you brought it up. Were you playing games with me, Paul? Because if you were, you'd better tell me, and I'll declare a mistrial right now, and we'll start this thing all over again." To Susan Dirks, Judge Peterson said, "Now, Mrs. Dirks, your colleague opened the door, and I want you to know that you can have as much latitude as you want to explore that drowning on cross." Rafferty didn't look at me as he finished his questions. He said simply, "So you felt that you were causing harm?" "Everything feels hurtful still. This trial has hurt all of us, my children and my husband, and also the Mackesies." In his most slow, solemn tones, Rafferty asked, "Did you ever sexually abuse Robbie Mackesy, Mrs. Goodwin?" I shook my head. I was supposed to be honest, forthright, and indignant. He was waiting for me to use words. He tapped his foot 4 or 5 times. "No," I managed to croak. "No, I did not." I knew that Susan Dirks could now ask me about the drowning. I waited for the questions that would turn the jury against me. "Did you like Robbie Mackesy?" she asked as she began her cross-examination. "No," I said. "He was a difficult boy." "Is that reason for a professional health care worker to dislike a child, because they are difficult?" "It wasn't necessarily right for me to dislike Robbie," I said. "I guess our reason isn't always responsible for our inclinations. It's a fact that I found him difficult, and that I didn't like being with him."
"You hit him?"
"Yes."
"Are you aware that it is against the law for a school employee to hit a child?"
"Yes, I am."
"And still you struck him?"
"Yes."
"Where did you hit him?"
"On the cheek."
"He was sent to the nurse to you, and you struck him across the face?"
"That's correct."
"You knew it was against the law?"
"Yes."
"Did you report your conduct?"
"No."
"Did you notify anyone that you'd broken a state law?"
"No."
"So you lived with the knowledge that you hurt Robbie Mackesy, just as you lived with the knowledge of the other abuse?"
Rafferty rose with his objection.
"Stick to the facts," Judge Peterson muttered. "I hurt everybody," you said in your admission to Officer Melby. "That, to me, suggests something very active."
"For a parent," I said, "not taking action, not doing a certain thing, can be just as damaging as willfully striking a child. Not paying attention when they are taking a sharp knife off the counter, turning your back just for a minute when they are in the bath, letting go of their hand when they need you. Sometimes it seems that every minute, every second, there is peril." The officers and I, we were having a general conversation, so I thought. I meant that I was human, and that I had therefore hurt the people closest to me. She was about to speak, but I think I'd caught her off guard.
I hurt everyone, you said.
Yes, I did.
Did you tell your husband that you'd slapped Robbie?
No.
Did you tell your best friend, the social worker?
No.
You were secretive about it?
Yes, I said. I was.
When I sat back down next to Rafferty at our table, he kept his eyes on his legal pad. I didn't care if he was infuriated, didn't care if I would always receive a chilly reception at his door. If he had misjudged me and my acting capabilities, he had only himself to blame. I didn't know why Dirks hadn't asked me about Lizzie, and I wondered briefly if it was something again that I had only thought I'd said. But when she mentioned the drowning in her closing statement, Rafferty nodded. It served me right, he seemed to be saying, to have Dirks throwing the accident in the jurors' laps. He didn't lean over and whisper in my ear the way he had throughout the previous days. I was certain that for everyone in the courtroom, Lizzie was suddenly the only presence. How could the jurors think of anything but the girl who should have been among us? I wanted to stand and do my own part, stand before them and tell them exactly what had happened. I had gone upstairs to look for my swimsuit, and I couldn't find it. And I had stopped to look at some old pictures from my childhood. And all the while, Lizzie was on her way down the lane. I remember only bits and pieces from Rafferty's closing statement. After he'd admonished the jury about their duty, he said, "All right, then. Let's go right to the meat of the prosecution. Let's go down, as the great poet Mr. William Butler Yeats once said, to the foul rag and bone shop of the heart. Let us see what, if anything, has been proven beyond a reasonable doubt. Mrs. Dirks has shown to my satisfaction, and I suggest to yours as well, that Robbie Mackesy has been abused by someone." I prayed while he spoke. I stopped listening and prayed for strength and heart. When I was very young, I used to sit before my map of the world, imagining myself in an ideal country, alone and at peace. Now, if I could make the world over, I said to myself in my prayer, and as always, to Howard, if I could make an impossible new world, Howard, this is who you would see. You'd see Emma and Claire, and you'd see yourself and me. All together, dancing on the porch with the shades down, outcasts making a perfect circle. Chapter 22. It has taken me a long time to know how to remember last year. I've wondered if I should go back to the newspapers and clip the articles, put them in a scrapbook so that when they get older, the girls can see for themselves what happened. It's tempting to want to brush the whole thing under the carpet, hoping that none of it in any form will resurface. But for the most part, when I catch myself in the mirror and see that my eyes look different, the scars of last year so evident in my face, I know that I can't forget, and that, in truth, I don't want to forget. Howard has suggested, reluctantly it seems, that we go to family therapy. My guess is that Teresa put that idea in his head. Give me a little more time, I keep saying. A few more weeks. He always seems relieved when I put him off. He manages the dairy animals in the Lincoln Park Zoo in Chicago now, what we laughingly call the herd. I cannot tell anyone what my husband does for a living without also wanting to tell them that it is absurd what he does. The 6 cows are Holsteins, a word nothing at all like Golden Guernsey, a word you cannot say without looking as if you're masticating.
We can go out on the flat of our apartment roof near Wrigley Field and watch the Cubs play ball. Howard watches the game raptly from his lawn chair, not because he likes baseball particularly, but because we have the best seat in the city. If I'm awake in the early mornings, I watch him down the hall, sitting by himself in the kitchen, running his hands over the table we brought from the farm. His hands move in swirls, as if the table is a Ouija board about to give him an important message for his future. He has grown quieter, something I used to think impossible, like a turtle evolving into an animal that makes less noise. I don't know if he is raging or if he's merely resigned. If there's one thing I've learned over the years, and learned well, it's how to be still and wait. Periodically, he's so fiercely merry, determined to have a good time, that the rest of us, Emma, Claire, and I, slink away to our own corners. And yet once in a rare while, Howard and I are able to reach back to the quality of the old days, to sit at our table after the girls are in bed and talk into the night. It's as if we've somehow been, as Teresa would say, blessed with grace. On occasion, I have thought that we are where we belong, city people returned to the city. We have a sunny apartment, Howard goes off to work, and I am a full-time mother. We have Dan Collins to thank for Howard's job, for pulling strings with the director of the zoo. We have tried, half-heartedly, to incorporate a few details from Prairie Center into our urban landscape. Howard has built walnut shelves in the kitchen with wood from the farm, from trees he felled himself. Linnell's bookmark is on the floor by the futon, the first thing I see when I wake up. We had rolls of film from our farm life, which I recently gathered together in an album. After it was done, I put the thing out of reach, out of sight. As for city dwelling, there is the homeless man in our block, the Waldorf school Emma attends with children of all races and creeds, for which Nellie pays. There is the feeling of being in the midst of noise and trash and people and life. What throws me off every night when Howard comes home is the fact that he still smells like cows, like silage. He spends a fair amount of time at a desk, but he's also involved with the animals' daily care. And therefore, of course, he smells. Even when I am prepared for his entrance, I have to brace myself against the fragrance of grain and hay and manure, against all that those smells conjure, against hot summer afternoons and the marvel of the pop-up baler throwing a bale of hay onto the wagon. We have apparently left Lizzie behind us. She is, Reverend Neighbors said at one point to Howard, forever young. I wrote Teresa on what would have been Lizzie's third birthday, and she wrote back, a short note thanking me, telling us that she is pregnant. We're no longer friends, really, and yet I know that we are a part of each other's lives, in much the same way a dead parent or lover is only slightly beneath one's consciousness by day, and always behind closed lids in sleep. I walk Claire to the park on nice days, and I sit on the bench reading a magazine while she plays. Sometimes I talk with other women who are also sitting on benches with magazines on their laps. And if we discover that we have more in common than location and ages of children, and if she is lonely too and invites me for a cup of coffee, my heart races, and I try to get away before the exchange of telephone numbers. I'm not sure, I might tell her, how to be friends a little bit, and I don't have the strength to be friends at full tilt. I don't have the stamina for the obligation and trust that's required. I'm still preoccupied with the old life. I might tell my acquaintance that I have not yet fully moved into the present. I find myself lingering in our last days in Spring Grove because it was there and then that Howard and I, each in our own ways, began the long process of making peace. The Saturday after the trial, I asked him if I could use the car, that I'd like to run a few errands. I think he knew where I was going because he stood in the middle of the kitchen floor, pondering my request before he dug in his pocket for the keys. I drove out of town slightly under the speed limit, inspecting the Christmas decorations and the fields, beautiful in their drabness. I imagined I didn't know I was driving back to Prairie Center. I had always liked December because it was the beginning of the quiet season. The crops were in, the house was full of food. We were ready for any siege, and we could rest. In the mornings before Howard went out for chores, he'd start a fire in the stove, so that when I came down to get breakfast, there was always the good warmth and smell of wood burning. Although I had had to go to work, I often felt, just for a moment, that we were all shut in the glow of the generous hearth, in the house where there was color and music, the thick smell of our life that would go on and on despite the naked trees shivering, the bare cold world outside. Then, of course, I had to chase to get dressed, to wake the girls, to stir the oatmeal, to pack the lunches, to find mittens, to make a grocery list. But there was often that moment, coming down the stairs, turning on the dim yellow light over the stove, loving our shelter. When I got to Prairie Center, I parked up the way by the old Kressler place, and then walked along the road the quarter mile or so to the farm. I had wanted to come back since I'd been let out in September, but I hadn't had a way to get there during the week, and I wouldn't have had time anyway, with Emma gone for a short morning at school. I knew that Howard had driven over on the weekends a few times to get lumber and furniture, but I hadn't had the nerve to ask him to take us. It was clear that he hadn't wanted us to come. He had mentioned that the Boy Scout people were going to take the house down. It didn't look like much, and it would require more money to make sound than it was probably worth, and if it stood empty, it would only invite vandals. I walked in through the woods by the road. The house had been a good place, but I had been trying to tell myself day after day that we would find another. The woods were a different matter. I used to come out on winter nights, when the sky was heavy with stars. The shadowy trees, dignified and knowledgeable, seemed as much a part of the heavens as of earth. And I'd get the feeling that it wouldn't take much of anything to step into the blackness of the sky, that there wasn't any magic to becoming a part of it. On that December day, I walked over the carpet of wet brown leaves, touching the gray trunks one after the next. I could see the pond, dull and still in the distance. I leaned against an enormous bur oak, and it came to me then, not only in my intellect, but also in my limbs, my blood, my skin. Lizzie wasn't here in Prairie Center anymore. It was a comfort to feel the tree's cold, spiny bark through my sweater, to feel my own fingers in my mouth. The grief, I knew, wasn't really ever going to go away. I leaned there for a long time, feeling the sharpness, the weight of the thing that was Lizzie's absence. We would never understand what she had become. She probably wasn't anything independent of us anymore, and in each of us she was evident in different ways. In Dan's graying hair, his slow smile, in Teresa's faraway look, her nervous laugh, perhaps in a deeper tenderness. The pond had meant various things to all of the people who had lived on our farm, and it would be the Boy Scouts' best place. But for us, it would always be more than just what it was, a shallow hole filled with water, a few cold, nearly dead fish on the bottom. The water was motionless. It looked through the trees, as if it was a large eye that would have been grateful for a lid, for sleep. The terrible thing, I wanted to tell Howard, the terrible thing is that there is so much good, and gradually it slips away from you. I hadn't believed until last summer that loss is determined, charted in us from the start, as inevitable and fixed as blood type and eye color. As I stood against the tree, I remembered only days before, after the verdict was read, after I was acquitted. The jury had deliberated for 2 hours while we waited in the courtroom. The words, "What say you?" and "We find the defendant not guilty," rang in my ears, and the room began to reel around me. I didn't cry. I must have stood up because I found myself in Rafferty's plaid embrace. He hadn't spoken more than 5 words to me since my testimony. Howard was putting his arms around the two of us. The judge in his imposing desk, the jury members, the spectators, were slipping back and forth. I looked out over Rafferty's shoulder and I saw in one fixed place Mrs. Mackesy. Susan Dirks was patting her hand and talking at her. She was pale and dead still. Teresa stepped forward then, blocking her out as she grabbed Howard and hugged him, weeping into his neck. When she moved away, still keeping hold of his hand, Mrs. Mackesy had gone, vanished. Having an enemy is a strangely intimate affair, and I felt, even while I was hanging on to Rafferty, that already something was missing, the canker to which I'd grown accustomed. Rafferty grasped my wrists and adjusted me to face him squarely. "I have to rush off," he said. "We'll talk in a few days. We should very seriously think about suing Mackesy for damages." "No," I said. "You feel that way now, but you let it settle. You think about it." "No." "We'll talk," he said, leaning over to kiss my cheek. "Goodbye, sweetheart," he whispered. "You threw me for a goddamn loop, but you pulled it off. It couldn't have gone better. I couldn't have designed it more perfectly myself. Dirks knew if she brought it up in the cross, the jurors would feel even sorrier for you. It probably made her blood pressure go off the charts to pass up the opportunity. Did you plan it? It was a coup, my dear, a coup." "No," I said to his back. That morning, walking in our woods, it seemed as if everything had been out of focus all year, and gradually, very slowly, the lens was being turned, the picture coming clear. For Teresa, God was something that was outside of her, some unfathomable being who made the highway radiant. I thought in the harsh December wind that for me, God was something within that allowed me occasionally to see. Teresa had forgiven us, forgiven me. She had done so not long after Lizzie's death. I hadn't known that a person could so willingly forgive, didn't know what it meant, how it could be, what it was made of, the strange stuff called forgiveness. She had forgiven me nearly as soon as she thought to blame, so that her forgiveness was allied with what seemed a holy sort of understanding and love. They had looked as if they belonged, Howard and Teresa, when they walked out of the courtroom together, side by side, shoulder to shoulder, as if they were the ones who lived together and were going home to their supper. And I thought how much easier it would be for Howard to love someone like Teresa, someone whose trouble is clear. My misfortunes were messy, hard to pin down, brought upon me by my own hand. In the woods, it seemed to me that Teresa represented the world as a wholesome, good place, and that she must seem so for Howard, too. I walked around the marsh, scaring up some ducks and a few geese that hadn't yet gone south. I would someday soon try to tell Howard more about it, all of it, I said to myself. I didn't know who else I would live with if it wasn't Howard. Who else would understand the strangeness of our life? But I also knew that we might go along and along, that we might come to a point where we'd look back to find that the relationship had disappeared. I had walked out into the old orchard, looking at the brown, hard, rotten apples still hanging on the trees. I remembered the night, after the funeral, when I'd run into Teresa, and we had stood against the trees, talking. I was grateful for that accidental meeting. As much as it pained me to think of it, I loved that night, too. We hadn't realized it at the time, but the conversation had been our chance to make an ending. It had been a suitable and good end. I stood looking out across the fields, knowing, I thought, every stone, each clump of dirt, calling all of it ours. I wanted to take something, but I couldn't think what it should be. In the end, I looked and closed my eyes, holding it, keeping it. I had driven home then, back to Spring Grove, and we had spent the afternoon in the kitchen, cooking our long overdue Thanksgiving dinner. Howard had thought of it, had thought to haul the turkey out of the freezer compartment of the refrigerator. I made one of Nellie's famous Jell-O salads and pumpkin pie with the last of Howard's wheat flour. He peeled potatoes and, with Nellie's blow-by-blow instructions over the phone, pulled together her sacred stuffing. Shortly before the food was ready, the girls became insufferable. We fed them hot dogs and put them to bed. We came back downstairs, and by the light of two candles, we sat before our feast. We ate in silence for a while. We both knew we weren't going to be able to talk about the farm for a time. We couldn't talk about the future because we had no idea what or where it was. The present itself had for so long been uncertain, and we weren't ready to rehash the details and the chance that had brought us back to solid ground. We tried to find our way. I told him a few more bits and pieces about Dyshet and Sherry and Debbie. And he told me about the dream life of the Indians who lived a billion years ago in Wisconsin. After the meal, we put the turkey and Jell-O and stuffing into the refrigerator and blew out the candles, leaving the entire mess of the afternoon and evening in darkness. There were no lights on in the house anywhere, and we fumbled up the stairs to bed. I had gotten down under the covers and was waiting for him to wind his clock and slide in next to me. He sat, his elbows on his thighs, his head in his hands. "What is it?" I asked. "Is it the farm?" He shook his head. "That's not what's bothering me." "I don't know, Alice. I don't know." Although I couldn't have said what it was he needed to tell me, I had the sense of its color, its shape. It was like a small black haze hanging over him. It was something that he would say that would change us again. I thought of what he had come through, losing what he loved most. And I thought, too, of the separate journey I'd taken, the anger I'd felt at him in jail for the hundreds of little betrayals, and then how I'd come to have faith that at some point those feelings would be washed clean. For him, perhaps nothing had come clean. He lay down with his back to me. I could feel him shaking. I cried some too then, holding him in my arms, kissing his hair, feeling what for Teresa came easily, and what for me had always been difficult. All the same, I knew I was forgiving him. I had that miraculous clarity for an instant, and so I understood that the forgiveness itself was strong, durable, like strands of a web weaving around us, holding us.
The End. You've been listening to A Map of the World by Jane Hamilton, narrated by C.J. Critt and Frank Muller. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, Recorded Books recommends Animal Dreams by Barbara Kingsolver, also narrated by C.J. Critt. In Animal Dreams, a woman returns to the small Arizona town in which she was born, seeking a reconciliation with her ailing father, and finds that she can at last confront the memories that have been haunting her dreams. You'll find a wide selection of titles in the Recorded Books catalog, including bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. So to order another recorded book, or for a copy of our latest listing, please call us using the toll-free number found on the back of the book. You can order by phone with any major credit card, or by writing to us, or by faxing us. Don't forget to ask about easy 30-day rentals by mail. On our website, you can browse the catalog, hear about the latest releases, place orders, or tune into narrator profiles and author interviews. So visit us there at www.recordedbooks.com. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.